conference pulpit messages this week. Our speaker is Dr. Gary Chapman. He is the best-selling author of the Five Love Languages book and series. He's the director of marriage and associate pastor of Calvary Baptist Church in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, where he has served for nearly 50 years. Here is Dr. Gary Chapman with Preparation for Marriage.
Well, I want to speak to you today on the subject of preparation for marriage. Yeah. Anybody here single today but plan to get married in the future? Yeah. Almost every single I meet plans to get married in the future. But I want to speak to all of you. Some of you are, you don't even have anybody on the horizon. You're just hoping someday you're going to meet somebody that'll take you out for a hamburger. But I want to speak on the topic of preparation. And if you look in the Bible, you're going to find the Bible has a lot to say about preparation. In fact, I went to a concordance, and there's hundreds of references to preparation. Let me give you an example. Joshua chapter 1, verse 10. Joshua commanded the officers of the people, saying, "Pass through the host and command the people, saying, prepare food supplies. Within 3 days, you're going over Jordan." Isn't that interesting? God's going to do all the hard stuff to take them into the land, but he said, "You prepare the food." Ever wondered what had happened if they hadn't prepared the food? 1 Chronicles chapter 22, David prepared for the building of the temple. He was not to build it, but he prepared so that Solomon could build it. 2 Chronicles 12, verse 14 says of Rehoboam, "He did what was evil because he prepared not his heart to seek the Lord." The folly of not preparing. The Levites were told over and over again to prepare for the sacrifices. Proverbs chapter 30, verse 25 says, "The ants are a people not strong, but they prepare their food in the summer." Well, wouldn't you think that anything as important as marriage would require a great deal of preparation? Listen to the solemnness of this statement. This is Ephesians 5:31. "For this reason, a man shall leave his father and his mother, the people who we hope have cared for him or her for a lifetime, leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two will become one flesh." That is a quote from Genesis 2:24. God was the one who set up that principle. Marriage is designed of God to be the most intimate of all human relationships. We're going to share life intellectually and emotionally and socially and physically and spiritually, and we're going to share life to such a degree that it can be said of us, we become one. Now, that doesn't mean we lose our individuality, but it does mean we have a deep, deep sense of intimacy. And my observation is that married couples who learn how to do that find marriage extremely satisfying. And those who do not learn to do that find marriage to be extremely empty. And I don't think I have to tell you that there are literally thousands of married couples in this country who have never learned to have that kind of relationship. We're in deep trouble in this country when it comes to marriage. And it's not only outside the church, it's in the church. In fact, I believe that one of the reasons the church does not make a greater impact on the non-Christian world is that our churches are filled with married couples who have never gotten it together. And they have no motivation to say to their friends, "Wouldn't you like to be a Christian and be as miserable as we are?" They have no motivation to reach out because they're so miserable at home. Now, I want to say that I believe that if we would prepare for marriage. So what I'm suggesting to you today is that the time to prepare for marriage is now. We have this idea, generally held among Christians and non-Christians, that the time you start preparing for marriage is when you get engaged. And all of our pre-marriage counseling and all of our pre-marriage classes deal with engaged couples. I want to suggest to you the time to prepare for marriage is now. You may not have even met anybody yet, or you may have dated them one time, or you may still be hoping they're going to ask you, or you may have been dating for a semester or a year or 2 years, or you may be thinking seriously about getting married, or you may be already engaged. Wherever you are, right now is the time for you to begin to prepare for marriage. Most people spend far more time preparing for their vocation than they do for their marriage. And yet the marriage is going to have a much more profound impact on their vocation than anything else in the world. I mean, look at you. You're going to spend 4 years in undergrad. Some of you is going to take you 5 or 6, but normally 4 years in undergrad. You're getting ready to do something in the world. And many of you, when you finish here, you're going to either stay here in graduate school or go somewhere else in graduate school and spend a few more years. I remember my dad used to say, every time I finished the school, he'd say, "Now, son, you're going to get a job, right?" I said, "Well, Daddy, one more school, you know." But you're doing all this to get ready for a vocation, and I'm asking you, when are you going to get ready for marriage? And I'm suggesting that now's the time. I believe because we spend so much time getting ready for our vocation and so little time getting ready for marriage, that's why we do a better job on our vocation than we do in our marriages. I've spent the last 35 years of my life in the local church as a pastor and a counselor. I've listened to hundreds and hundreds of couples as they share their struggles in marriage. And I've tried to bring to light to them biblical truth and help them discover the kind of marriage God intended them to have. I've written a lot of books, and most of my books have been written on marriage and parenting. But about 3 years ago, I became deeply burdened with the subject I'm talking about today. And I really felt like that I needed to write a book on preparation for marriage that was not just for people who are engaged, but for all singles. But I knew in my heart that most singles are not going to read a heavy-duty academic book on marriage. And so I said to God, how can I write a book that will make sense to singles, that they will read it, and it will change their lives and challenge them to really prepare for marriage? And as soon as I asked God for wisdom, it came to my mind, my answer. And that is, I should share out of my own life and out of my experiences of 35 years sitting in the counseling office. And so I wrote a book called Things I Wish I'd Known Before I Got Married. Woo! You see, my wife and I had tremendous struggles in our marriage in the early years. We were both Christians before we got married. We had both gone to Christian institutions for education. We had prayed about getting married. We believed it was God's will for us to get married. In fact, before we got married, I could hardly wait to be as happy as I was going to be when we got married. I had all these visions and all these dreams. I envisioned romantic breakfast with my wife. Oh, wouldn't that be wonderful? But after we got married, I found out that she did not do mornings. I could have found that out before we got married, but I didn't. I only saw her in the evenings. I never saw her in the mornings. I didn't know she didn't wake up till 10. She gets up, but she doesn't wake up, you know. I didn't know that before we got married. 6 months into our marriage, I was more miserable than I'd been my whole life. And so was she. And that's probably why I've invested my life in trying to help people with their marriages. But I believe that there's a whole lot of things that I know now that had I known before I got married, it would have made our marriage a whole lot easier. But I want to share some of these things with you that I know now that I wish I'd known then. Number one, I wish I'd known that being in love is not an adequate foundation for marriage. I didn't know that. I mean, I went to my mother and I said, "Mom, how do you know when you're really in love?" And my mother said what many mothers have said through the years. She said, "Son, if it's real, you'll know it." Well, I liked my mother, but that didn't help me. But I had this euphoric feeling. In fact, someone has said, love is the feeling that you feel when you feel a feeling like you've never felt before. And that's certainly the way I felt it. I mean, she was the most wonderful woman I'd ever met in my life. And I had these huge emotions for her. And I just sensed I was going to have this forever, and we were going to feel this way forever. But nobody told me what I know now. And that is the average lifespan of the euphoria is 2 years. Some a little longer, some a little less. Average 2 years, we come down off the high. Nobody told me that. Well, I'm saying thank God we come down off the high. Because if we didn't, you'd have to close down business, industry, church, education. You can't get anything done when you're in love. Being in love is next door to being insane. You fall in love in college and your grades are likely to go down. It's hard to study when you're in love. Got a test on the War of 1812. Who cares about the War of 1812 when you're in love? But see, nobody told me this. I thought I had the real thing. I thought it was going to last forever. And had I known it lasted an average of 2 years, I think I would have been better prepared. But I was not prepared. And we'd been dating a little about 2 years when we got married. And so about 6 months into the marriage, I came down off the high. And I lost those feelings. And then I started seeing these things about her that I didn't like. Now, I didn't see them before. Because when you're in love, you don't see things you don't like. You just like everything about them. I mean, my wife would say before we got married, "Honey, I want to have 5 boys when we get married." I'm in love, and I say, "Okay, honey, that's fine, whatever you want, 5 or 10, you know, just whatever you want." That's the way you are when you're in love, whatever you want, you know. But that's not the way you are when you come down off the high. You go back to being normal. And normal means we're selfish, and we want what we want. But see, nobody told me that. And when I came down off the high, I was disillusioned. And the thoughts started coming to my mind, I married the wrong woman. Surely, if I'd married the right woman, it wouldn't be this hard. And then I got mad at God. And I said, "Look, I prayed and I asked you not to let me marry her if it's not the right one, and you let me do it." And I'm mad at God now because God got me into this mess. You see, if I had been prepared and known that it's normal to come down off the high, then I would have been anticipating it. And if I had known that it was normal that we go back to being selfish and wanting what we want and seeing things in them we didn't see before, if I'd been prepared for that, and if I had known that there's 2 stages of romantic love, one is the falling in love experience, the other is much more intentional, and that's where the whole love language thing comes in, that we have to learn how to speak their love language if you want to keep love alive in the relationship. I didn't know that in those days. I knew nothing about love languages. I didn't know you had to learn to love. That didn't make sense to me. And it doesn't make sense to most people today that you have to learn to love. I remember a young lady who was in love. I met her in the airport. She was going to see her fiancé, and she asked me, "What do you do?" I said, "Well, I'm a marriage counselor, and I lead marriage seminars." And she said, "What do you do at marriage seminars?" And I said, "Well, I help people learn how to work on their marriage." And she said, "Work on your marriage? Why would you have to work on a marriage?" I knew she was in love. She's right where I was before I got married. You don't think you have to work on a marriage, but you do. You have to learn how to love. And so in this book, I give a little recap of the 5 love languages. Number 2, I wish I'd known that the old saying, like mother, like daughter, like father, like son, is not a myth. Look at his father if you want to know what he's going to look like in 10 years. Look at her mother if you want to know what she's going to look like in 10 years. If his father is an alcoholic, there's a good chance he will be in 10 years. If his father is a domineering person, there's a good chance he's going to be domineering. If her mother interrupts her husband when he's telling a story and says, "Oh, no, honey, it wasn't Wednesday, it was Thursday. Oh, no, honey, that wasn't 1932, 1994, that was 1995. If she interrupts him when he talks, she will likely interrupt you when you talk 10 years from now. Gary, you don't mean that I'm destined to be like my daddy. You don't mean I'm destined to be like my mother. No, I'm not saying that. But I'm saying if you don't want to be like your father and like your mother, you better start working on it now. Not after you get married, not after you get engaged, now. If, for example, his father is an alcoholic, he needs to be working on that now and studying alcoholism and studying stress and how you handle stress in a more positive way and learning some things so that he won't fall into that, and he best stay away from alcohol altogether. None of this social stuff for him. He stay away from it forever. He doesn't want to be like his daddy. So here's what I'm saying. Now, look at your mother, if you're a gal. Look at your father, if you're a guy, and ask yourself, what are the things about my mother and father that I would like to emulate? And I hope you're going to find a lot of things that you'd like to be like your mother in this area and like your father. And I hope you're going to find a lot of things. But then ask yourself, are there things in my mother or my father that I don't want to be like that? And make a list of them. And then you start asking, what can I do now so that I don't turn out to be like this? Because if you just put it on automatic pilot and don't worry about those things, I can tell you, you're far more likely to be like them and repeat those things. But you can start now to change those things. But you got to get a list first of what are the things that you do not want to emulate in your parents. Number three, I wish I'd known how to solve disagreements without arguing. Well, you know, when I was in love, I didn't anticipate we would have any disagreements. And I certainly was not prepared to handle disagreements. I had no plan for how you solve disagreements. And you know what happens if you don't have a plan? You argue. You argue. And that's where thousands of couples are and have been, some of them for years, arguing. Because you see, when you come down off the high and come back to being normal, your idea is the right idea. Otherwise, why would you have it? I mean, you have an idea that wasn't right. But you see, you're married to somebody who's human. This is one of the great things we discovered as anthropologists. You know, my background was anthropology before I studied theology. You know what we discovered? That if you get married, you're going to marry a human. Mm-hmm. And humans don't think the same way, and humans don't feel the same way, and you will not be married long when you come down off the high, when you're going to find out that she thinks this is the way it should be done, he thinks this is the way it should be done, and you both feel strongly about it, and if you don't have a plan for handling that, what you're going to do is argue. He's going to tell you why he thinks his idea is right, and you're going to tell him why you think your idea is right, and then he's going to tell you what's wrong with your idea, and you're going to tell him what's wrong with his idea, and it's going to get louder as you move along, and before long, you're screaming at the person that you loved so dearly before you got married. And none of us like to argue. So what happens? One of two things. One of you just caves in and says, okay, darling, we'll do it your way. And if you're Christian, it's normally the wife that caves in because she's thinking about that submission thing. And so she just, okay, honey, it's whatever you want, you know. But inside, she resents it, you know. And that's one way. And the other way is that you don't solve anything. Nobody gives in. You get real high, and then one of you walks out and slams the door, and you don't discuss that anymore. And that one goes under the rug. And so you got this disagreement that you haven't solved. And then a month later, you have another one, and it goes under the rug, and another one, and another one. And you get all these things under the rug that you don't agree on, you never solved. And then what happens? The thought comes to your mind, we shouldn't have gotten married. We're just not compatible. We don't agree on anything. I don't know how we got married. You see, and you start courting that idea, and you know where that leads. So I wish I'd had a plan for handling argument. I wish I'd known how to solve differences without arguing. And the essential ingredient, I go into this thoroughly in the book, but the essential ingredient is learning how to listen empathetically. And I can tell you, most of us don't know that by nature. By empathetically, I mean you put yourself in the shoes of the other person and try to look at the world through their eyes with their personality and their background and try to understand how they could think what they're thinking and how they could feel what they're feeling. We don't do that by nature. We're thinking about what I think and what, and that's why we get into arguments. If you don't learn to listen empathetically, you will never solve argument. You'll never solve disagreements without arguing. But if you learn to listen empathetically, then you can honestly say to the other person, you know, now that I hear you, I think I understand what you're saying, and it makes a lot of sense. And it always makes sense in their head. And so when you say it makes a lot of sense, you're always telling the truth. It makes a lot of sense. Because you've gotten into their head, you understand now how they could come to that conclusion. Then you can say, honey, let me share my perspective. And now you can share your perspective, and because you heard them out and affirmed them, they now hear you out and affirm you, and then the two of you can say, okay, honey, it's obvious we disagree. How can we solve the problem? And you spend your energy looking for a solution rather than spending your energy arguing with the other person. Did you ever stop to think, if you win an argument, the other person lost? It's no fun to live with a loser. So why would you create one? I wish I'd known that. Man, that would have saved a lot of hurt and a lot of pain in the early years of my marriage if I'd known that. Number four, I wish I'd known that apologizing is a sign of strength. You know what we discovered? Several years ago, I wrote a book with Dr. Jennifer Thomas called The Five Languages of Apology. You know what we discovered? 10% of the population never apologize. And most of them are men. And they were taught it by their fathers, either verbally or by their model. Their fathers said, real men don't apologize. You do the best you can, and you go on. If somebody gets hurt, that's their problem. And that's the way they go into marriage. My father never told me that, but my father never modeled apologizing. I had a good father. He was a Christian man. I greatly admire him. A lot of positive things about him that I mean, most things were positive. But every once in a while, my father would lose his temper, and he would speak harshly to my mother. And my mother would just clam up. I guess she had learned in the early years, if she spoke up, it would be an argument, so she just clammed up. And then Dad would wind down. But I never heard my father ever apologize to my mother. And so I came into marriage with no model of apologizing. It just never crossed my mind that I would ever need to apologize. And so I would do my thing, you know, and I'd get loud with her, but I wouldn't go back and apologize. I just figured, well, she's part of it. The reality is you will never have a healthy marriage unless you learn to apologize. So I want to challenge you. What I'm saying is these are things you can learn before you get married, how to apologize. Not just to the person you're dating, but to your roommate or to somebody else that you run into a difficulty with. Learning to apologize. Number five, I wish I'd known that toilets are not self-cleaning. Now, this is, if you're engaged, you need to camp out on this one. If you're already engaged, all you folks getting married in May and June, you need to camp out on this one. 6 weeks into our marriage, I said to my wife one day, you know, honey, the toilet's dirty. And she said, I know. I was wondering when you're going to clean it. And I said, me? I don't know how to clean toilets. She said, I can teach you. You see, we never talked about who's going to clean the toilet before we got married. I just assumed she would. She assumed I would. And the toilet was dirty. Now, I'm obviously not talking simply about toilets. I'm talking about who's going to do what after you get married. Now, if you're engaged, here's your assignment. If you're engaged, here's your assignment. Make a list of all the things that will have to be done after you get married. Somebody's got to buy groceries, somebody's got to cook, somebody's got to wash dishes, somebody's got to vacuum floors, somebody's got to clean the toilet, somebody get the white spots off the mirror, and on and on and on and on and on. All these things are going to have to be done when you get married, inside and outside the house. So make a list, and then separately, take your list and go get a loan, and you put your initials by the ones you think you're going to do, and put their initials by the ones you think they're going to do. Then bring your list back together and see what you agree on. And maybe you agreed on 2/3 of them. And so you're both going in with the same picture on that. But on the other third, where you thought he would do it, he thought you would do it, now is the time to talk about that and decide who's going to clean the toilet. And if you decide that now, then you move into marriage and you'll have a clean toilet. But if you don't discuss it, I can tell you the toilet's going to be dirty. And you're going to have an argument over who's going to clean it, you know, after you get into the marriage. So what I'm saying is, I wish I'd known that we needed to work out that before we got married. It would have saved us a whole lot of hassle. Number 6, I wish I'd known that spirituality is not to be equated with going to church. You know, the common question that we ask people if they tell us that they're engaged, you know, if you're a pastor, you always say, well, now, is he a Christian? And they say, oh, yeah, he goes to St. Mark's. You know, there's all kind of Christians. I mean, there's Sunday morning Christians. Yeah, there's Easter Christians. There's Christmas Christians. There's Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night Christians. There's daily devotional Christians. I mean, Christian doesn't mean a whole lot in our culture. 80% of the people will tell you they're Christians. What I want to know is, are you marching to the beat of the same drummer? You know, I was talking with Dr. James Ford, pastor of the church in Chicago, African-American pastor, and I said to him, you know, what do you advise people on how to find a spouse? And he said, I advise them that you run as hard toward Jesus as you can run, and you look over your shoulder, and if you see a boy or a girl keeping up with you, that's probably the one. I wish I'd known that spirituality is a whole lot more than saying I'm a Christian. It has to do with where you are in the journey and where your heart beats. You know, if you sense God has called you to be a missionary and the person you're in love with loves Mercedes, that should be a red flag, because missionaries don't normally drive Mercedes. You see, let's be realistic about where we are. I don't mean you have to be at the same place. None of us are exactly at the same place. But here's the question. Are they moving toward Jesus? Because if they're not moving toward him, it means they're drifting away from him. You don't ever stay. No relationship stays static. You either are drifting apart or you're moving together. And you want to make sure that your hearts are beating together. Number 7. I wish I'd known that we needed a plan for handling our money. Now, we didn't need that, really, the first 3 years, because I was in graduate school and we didn't have any money. If you don't have any money, you don't need a plan. But as soon as we got some money, we didn't have a plan. Now, what I'm saying is this. When it comes to money, there's only 3 things you can do with it. You can give it away, you can save it, or you can spend it. Now, before you get married, you ought to decide, how are you going to do that? You know, if one of you grew up as a Christian and you gave 10% of your money to God from a child, your parents taught you that and you've been doing that all your lifetime, and now you're marrying somebody and they think that that's Old Testament, you don't give 10%, you just give whatever God leads you to give, which is usually 1%. You know, I can tell you this is going to be a problem for you. Because your heart's going to beat to give God 10%, and their heart's not beating to give 10%. And you're going to feel like God's not going to bless us if we're just going to tip him. You know, and you're going to get into all that. But you can decide all that before you get married. You ought to be discussing that when you get serious about dating. You ought to be discussing that. And let me throw this out. You also need to put on the table the reality of your assets and liabilities before you get married. If he owes $20,000 in college debt, that needs to be laid on the table before you get married. Don't reveal that 6 months after you get married. What? $20,000? Why didn't you tell me? Yeah. No. Lay it on the table beforehand and discuss these issues. Well, I'm going to have to close. But Let me just mention the titles of a couple other chapters. I wish I'd known that mutual sexual fulfillment is not automatic. There's a reason why God said to Israel, take a year for your honeymoon. No war and no work. Take a year for your honeymoon. There's a reason God said that to Israel. And not many couples find mutual sexual fulfillment in less than a year. It's a process. Oh, I wish I'd known that. I thought it was going to be heaven for both of us. It didn't turn out to be heaven for both of us. And most couples will tell you the first year is not heaven. We have to, just as we have to learn to grow intellectually and emotionally and socially and spiritually, we have to grow sexually. Man, I wish I'd known that before we got married. Well, I'm going to stop. But you get the heart of what I'm saying. I really believe that today is the day for you to be preparing for marriage, and I want to challenge you to get on task with preparing for marriage while you're preparing for everything else. Let's pray. Our Father, how grateful we are for the few moments we've had today to reflect upon this powerful, powerful subject. And you know that in our culture, we leave it all until we get engaged, and then we start thinking about preparing. Father, open our eyes to know that wherever we are, it's time to be getting ready for the most important human relationship we will ever have. I pray that we will all think differently about preparation for marriage because we spent these moments together. In the name of Christ, our Lord, our Savior. Amen.